Welcome to Your Cyber Path, the podcast that helps you get your dream cybersecurity job by sharing the secrets of experienced hiring managers and top cybersecurity professionals with you. Now, on to the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Your Cyber Path. My name is Kip Boyle, and I'm here with co-host Jason Dion. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Kip. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, it's good to see you, too. And I just found out today that there's a chance to actually meet up in person again, believe it or not. This thing about you relocating to Orlando is working really well for me, just so you know. I don't know how you like it, but I like it because this is, it turns out I'm going to Orlando again to make a presentation at the ISSA Cybersecurity Executive Forum, and that's going to happen in September, and going to go talk to a bunch of CFOs from global companies. But while I'm there, hopefully we can find some time to meet up and have a meal. And you have a new office. Maybe I could see that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're in the middle of still moving from Puerto Rico up to Orlando. We'll be finishing that move in 2023. But right now we have the offices at least finished. They finished that as of this morning. So they're ready to be moved into. And I will be in town when you're in town. So we'll definitely have to catch up. That is one of the nice things about Orlando is it's Orlando and Vegas is where all the conventions seem to be. So you get a lot of conventions and conferences. So I get a lot of friends who are flying in, flying out. I get to hang out with them when they come into town.
Yeah, how super convenient for you. And I love that it is a direct flight from Seattle to Orlando because I don't like changing planes. I'm done with that.
Yeah, a lot less likely to have your luggage get lost when you don't have to change planes, which is nice.
And it doubles my transit time, you know, coast to coast. It just completely blows out my day and makes it so much longer than it needs to be. Anyway, it's good to be back recording our episode here. Hey, what we're going to do today, everybody, is we're going to take a closer look at something called the NIST Risk Management Framework. Now, this is a really important document if you're working in the Department of Defense, various parts of the U.S. federal government on the civilian side. And we're trying to bring more information about this to you, our audience. And we thought the best way to do that was to get an expert. So on the podcast with us today is an RMF expert. His name is Drew Church. He's the global security strategist with Splunk. If you've heard of Splunk, I'll let Drew tell us what Splunk is. But Splunk is a really important tool for people working in cybersecurity. Hey, Drew, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Kip. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Jason. Jason and I go back quite a ways. And I also learned just a few moments ago that you're from, or at least located in Seattle. When I'm not TDY for several months to Virginia, I actually live about an hour outside of Seattle. So hopefully we'll have a chance to meet up face to face. But yeah, so Splunk, we're a big data platform. We do analytics. A lot of security use cases that we have in Splunk. That's kind of where I got my start with the technology is actually doing part of continuous monitoring for RMF using Splunk. So we can definitely talk a little bit about that. I'm not here on their dime today or anything like that, not a sponsored show or anything like that. It's just me talking, but happy to be here.
Yeah, as we have with a lot of other guests, you know, the opinions expressed by Drew are Drew's opinions alone, and they do not reflect upon Splunk, who is his employer. So I just want to make sure we all pointed that out. He works for Splunk, but he's not here representing Splunk.
Yep. Yeah, and the opinions might not even be mine. That was a joke.
But yeah, as Drew said, him and I go way back. We actually worked together several years ago in a cybersecurity organization, and we spent quite a bit of time working together, and we've kept in touch over the years. So when we started diving into RMF, I started thinking about who in my network has a lot of experience in RMF, and Drew was one of like the top three names that came to my head. So I immediately reached out to him and invited him onto the show so we could talk about RMF. And the thing I wanted to mention with RMF is, as Kip said, this tends to be used very heavily in the government, especially in the DoD, for either military, contractors, or civilians. That said, if you're not working for one of those organizations, I still would listen today because RMF is one of those things that if you end up working for one of these government contractors one day, or you even work for a software as a service company that has a contract with the DoD, you sometimes have to deal with that. For instance, Splunk is not a DoD person, but they do sell a lot of things to the DoD, and so they have to go through this RMF process as well with some of their tools to get them approved for use on the different networks in the DoD. So we'll be talking about that as well as we go through today.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, so what we want to do is really, we want to get into RMF. So RMF is a framework that has seven steps. But I think maybe before we get into those seven steps, it might be nice to talk a little bit about what RMF is, what it's not, at a high level. So Jason did, or Drew, would one of you guys like to just kind of give us the thumbnail sketch of the purpose of RMF?
Sure, I'll let Drew jump in here if he wants.
Yeah, RMF, the risk management framework, is that seven-step process. And the really idea is to right-size and come up with the right amount of security for the right system at the right time and at the right cost. And so if you think about the whole program as that and work from that outwards, it gets a lot easier. I did mention cost, and so hopefully those of you in the commercial sector that are thinking about that, you hear bureaucracy and you hear cost, and those things usually are pretty high. I think there's a way to do RMF at the right cost, but the big picture there is selecting the right kind of security for the system or systems or company or organization, and do that correctly and in a pretty systematized, systematic way.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because when you're dealing with RMF, the idea is not to 100% secure every single system out there. It's a matter of managing risk, which is why it's called the RMF, the risk management framework. And so if I have something that is going to be used by one person and connected to one dial-up computer terminal, it's not even connected to the internet normally, there's probably a less of a risk posture there, and I wouldn't want to spend billions of dollars protecting that. On the other hand, if I have, you know, a mobile device that can process top secret information, I probably want to spend a lot of money protecting that because it's mobile and it has top secret information. So we want to make sure that is well protected. And so this allows you to kind of, you know, as Drew said, right size based on what the thing is you're trying to protect. And the whole idea with RMF, at least in my experience, is to get to a point where an authorizing official can decide yes or no, we're willing to accept the residual risk of this thing when we connect it to a network. Because you're never going to get 100% of the things taken care of when you're putting all your controls together. There's just no way to protect everything 100% of the time. And so you just want to get it down to a reasonable level where the risk is willing to be accepted based on the benefits you're going to get.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I think that's an excellent summary. There's another thing that I'd like to point out before we really start unpacking the seven steps and getting Drew's take on the kind of the reality of using the seven steps, because there's what's documented, there's what, you know, the government's looking for, and then there's like how do you really do it in the real world? But the other thing I want to say that I think is really important and helpful to understand RMF is that it's based on a lifecycle development process. Like that seems to be the major lens through which RMF describes what needs to be done. And I like to compare and contrast that to the NIST cybersecurity framework, because some people seem to have this idea that they're just sort of like synonymous with each other. And in my experience, I don't think that it's very synonymous. I actually think it's complementary, because the cybersecurity framework is actually organized around the five steps of a computer incident and how you handle it. And so I think that's a really important distinction. But Drew, what's your opinion of that?
Yeah, I think that they are complementary. I think that everything inside of the cybersecurity framework is inside of RMF, and then RMF has a ton more stuff. But it is organized differently, and I think that makes it significantly more approachable for smaller organizations or less mature organizations. They could be a Fortune 5 company and very immature, or they could be a mom and pop that stood up yesterday, you know. And at the end of the day, both of those control sets, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, they are at the end trying to help you figure out what to do and how to do it, and actually make some help you make smarter purchasing decisions, which is another interesting topic as well. And so overall, I think no matter how you approach it, either from the RMF side or from the cybersecurity framework side, you're getting the same goodness really coming out of NIST and the experts there.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've seen a lot of people who they say CSF and RMF in the same sentence, and they think they're the same thing. In fact, when Kip and I started making our NIST cybersecurity framework course, we were working with Udemy Business to get it added to their catalog. They were actually asking for a NIST cybersecurity framework and RMF course. And we're like, whoa, 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 that's not the same thing. Let's do one. And then, you know, if you want the other one, we'll make the other one too. And we are, we're currently making an RMF course to go through how you actually do this in the real world. But we had to, you know, break that apart for them, because most people, when they talk to hiring managers, when they talk to HR, when they talk to all the people in the instruction and recruitment areas of these large Fortune 500 businesses they deal with, they kept hearing, we want CSF and RMF. And they thought that was one thing. We're like, no, those are two different things. They just work really well together. So that's why we're going to talk about that in this episode. And I guess that brings us to the first thing we should do, which is lay out what are the seven steps of RMF. So I'll go ahead and kind of read those off at a very high level. And then we're going to talk with Drew as we go through some of these steps and kind of figure out what does this look like in the real world? Where are the pain points? Where are the, the bodies buried, I guess, as you start dealing with the stuff in the real world. So when we look at the seven steps, as we said, it is a lifestyle, a life cycle. So it starts out with prepare. And during the prepare phase, you're going to be doing all the essential activities to prepare your organization to be able to manage your security and your privacy risks. When you look at RMF, really, there's two big risk areas they focus on. One is the security risks or the cybersecurity of your organization. And the second is the privacy risks because of all the data breaches that occur. And so these are two main areas you're going to be focused on. The second step is to categorize. During the categorize phase, we're going to be categorizing our systems and all the information that it processes, stores, and transmits based on an impact analysis. And this goes back to what Drew said when we start talking about right sizing. Yes, you can categorize a system as, extremely important and needs to be protected at all costs. But if it's going to cost $1 billion to protect this thing and it's only protecting a piece of data that's worth a dollar, that doesn't make a lot of sense either. So you want to make sure you're categorizing things in the right mind based on the information it's processing and the level of that information. The third step is select. When you're selecting, you're going to be going through the control sets, which are located in the NIST Special Publication 800-53, the same one that we referenced back in our NIST Cybersecurity Framework course as one of the places you can get controls from. And this is why these work together. And you're going to select the controls based on the risk assessment of the systems and the data you're trying to protect. Then we get to step four. This is where we're going to implement. So we want to implement all those controls we selected. For instance, we said we're going to implement two-factor authentication. We're going to use data at rest encryption. Now we have to go put all those things into the system. And that's where the implement step is. Then we get down to our next step, which is to step five, which is to assess. Now that we've implemented our controls, we need to assess to determine if those controls are in place, if they're working right, and if they're giving us the results that we expected. For example, if we said we're going to protect the system using multi-factor authentication, and we decide to use an SMS text code for that, and then we find out that those can be easily hacked or bypassed, well, that's not giving us the protection we want, so maybe we want to move to an RSA key fob token solution instead for our multi-factor authentication. That's the idea of assess. Is this working the way we intended? Then we get to number six, which is our authorize step. In authorize, this is where your senior officials start making risk-based decisions to authorize the systems to operate. And in every organization, whether you're a government organization or a civilian organization, somebody should be making a decision of when you can hook something up to the network. And that senior official, whoever that is going to be responsible for all the risk that is now being accepted by that organization because somebody has to make that determination. And then the final thing we do is step seven, which is monitor. At this point, we're going to continuously monitor our systems and monitor all of our controls to make sure they're working the way they should, to make sure the risk is at the level we thought it was. And if those risks start creeping up and getting higher, then we want to go back and iterate again and start categorizing, selecting, implementing, assessing, authorizing, and monitoring again to make our systems more secure and reduce that risk again. And again, this all goes back to how you've categorized things back in step two, so you know what level you need to meet. So, guys, do you think I did a decent job of covering the 50,000-foot view?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason.
All right, cool. So let's talk a little bit about prepare. What happens during the prepare stage, and what does this look like in the real world?
Yeah, and so when we start thinking about preparing, right, you're going in and digging deep as to, like, actually looking about what you're trying to do. And I think I like to think that there's like a step before prepare, but it's really all part of the prepare. You have to look at this as a system of systems. You have to look at your organization. You have to look at the left and right lateral limits that you're operating under. You have to understand who those people are. You need to identify folks. Like you mentioned, that senior risk official or the risk executive, whomever this happens to be, those people have to be identified. You have to understand, what the part of the organization is. If there are legal constraints, you have to understand about, in those more military or government sectors, of the appropriate, rank and whatnot to be able to make those decisions. So you have to do a lot of kind of pre-work before you even get into the RMF stuff, which is a big picture to me, and the thing I think about is like understanding hierarchies of systems. And so take big picture, right? You've got a multinational corporation, and there's going to be, we'll say, six different sites, right? And so when you're thinking about, you know, the prepare step, are you looking and are going to be embracing this as the overall entire organization? Or are you looking at doing it for one of those six locations in a specific location? When you take that and then also think about this concept of common controls. And these are things that I think, and this is where real world, I wish people did a little bit more of it, thinking about this big picture, is saying, hey, if you go look at that category of controls, there are things like traditional security controls. Do I have the right locks on my doors? Do I have the right, you know, fire suppression systems and other environmental controls? Do I have redundant power? The things that start getting into the kind of the availability in the CIA triad, which I am sure you talk a lot about. Think about that, right? One site may be different than another, but when you think about maybe the background investigations that all people that come into the organization have to go through, they're all the same. Yep. And so that might be a great opportunity to identify those common controls around personnel security that apply to all systems so that you answer them once and once only. Because what I see in the real world are folks that don't understand what their common controls are. And this is where you get into the concept of inheritance and saying, hey, I'm inheriting that from another system that I've authorized because, yep, you know what? Everybody that works on my system was already vetted through our organizational policies. I don't need any more. Boom, I'm not going to have to answer that. And that flows into other steps. So when you get this done right at the outset, it significantly saves time, it saves money, and quite frankly, it saves sanity throughout all of it. And so really, regardless, if you're working on the big system or you're working on that super hyper important system in a corner that does really important but small scale work, it's all setting it up to right size, the right amount of security to apply and manage that risk effectively.
Yeah. And I think one of the really interesting things in what you just said, Drew, is, you know, we tend to be, as cybersecurity folks, always thinking about the technical solution. But you, you know, went right out to prepare and you thought about, hey, what about those physical solutions, right? What about those door locks? What about the personal background checks and all those things? Because you're right. A lot of that, especially in large organizations, a lot of the listeners know I used to be in the Navy. And in the Navy, we have networks all over the world across six different continents. And a lot of those same things and those same people are moving between different areas. And so if you're working in the United States versus working in Italy or the Middle East or in Japan, and I've worked in all of those places, we had different requirements at the physical security level. There was a baseline, and the lowest level was here in the United States. When I was overseas, they had a higher threshold. So we accepted all those controls from the people coming from the United States and then added to those what was unique to our particular site. And I think when you're looking at prepare and seeing how can you reuse the work of others, that's really where this comes into as making sure you're ready to start the whole process.
You know, as a person working in private sector only, Drew, when you were talking about this, what the thing that popped into my mind was when I use a cloud provider, they operate on a shared responsibility model. And when I use like an AWS service, for example, like S3, where I can store objects in the cloud, I actually inherit all the controls that Amazon already has in place, like yes, data center security and so forth, right? And so to me, yes, conceptually, that seems very similar. Am I getting it?
100%. And nobody thinks about it, right? You're like, oh, a cloud world. I'm so far advanced. I've moved past things like risk management framework. Ha ha, you really haven't. It's just the same thing under different guise, right? So that shared responsibility model, exactly, 100%, Kip.
Got it. Okay, that's cool. All right. Well, anything else, Drew, in the prepare step that is particularly maybe difficult to understand or tricky to get right, or just anything else that you could share with our audience, you know, if they find themselves working on this step?
This is where you, the project management skills, right? Understanding organization, right? You're going to probably have some tooling. They may be, if you're in the DoD, you're going to know the system you're going to be doing this in, depending on the classification of the environment. Like, hey, what tool or technology are you going to use for this? And there's a lot of, by the way, Microsoft Excel and Microsoft Word going through that whole process, but there's also like other tools. And so you're probably going to be using those. So understanding those, understanding who has access to do what, figuring out the roles of the people involved, right? We mentioned that authorizing official. There's other roles like the information system owner, other things like assessors that go into this other parts of the process. And so part of that prepare step is identifying those people. Mm. And so making sure that you know who's on the hook for what and kind of when. Because if you choose the wrong people and you're like on a timeline, it's not going to go so well. So understand all of that, get that kind of, and start building those relationships as soon as possible within whatever the chains that you can to make sure that the whole process is successful. It's all about getting prepared. It's in the name to get this whole process done as easily and as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to bring up, you know, when we talk about RMF is it's a lengthy process sometimes. I've done several RMF packages. The fastest I think I've gotten one through was about 5 months, and people thought I was lightning fast because 5 months is really unheard of in the RMF world. Generally, it can take you 1 to 2 years to get these things from the time you start preparation to the time you have finally gotten everything approved and authorized in step six and ready to actually put that thing on the network. So the preparing, the more you can do in preparation, the better you're going to be as you move through the rest of the steps, because you can grease the skids a lot of times. As Drew said, if you have a choice of, you know, person A or person B, and you know that person B always lets things sit in their inbox for a month before they look at it, and person A is kind of top of their game, you may want to swing by person A's desk and buy them a cup of coffee and see if they're willing to be the guy who's going to, you know, the person going through your RMF package instead of getting stuck with person B, right? And I've seen a lot of that where it's not necessarily, you know, buying off the person who's going to be looking at your stuff, but it's just getting yourself a higher priority, especially when they're competing for that one person may have 1,000 packages they're looking at, and they only have time to look at one a day or two a day. So trying to get yourself as a higher priority sometimes can work wonders.
I know we're all IT and cyber professionals, but soft skills, folks, soft skills matter.
Yes, so we'll talk about that time and time again on this podcast. Like, being likable will get you to the top of the queue. It's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you, Drew, for saying that, because Jason and I emphasize the importance of people skills all the time, soft skills. And so we didn't pay Drew to say that. He said it on his own because he knows it's true. But I appreciate you weighing in on that. How about the second step, the categorized step? Drew, what would you tell somebody, again, who's doing RMF for the first time? What are your insights about how to get this step done as quickly and as cleanly as possible?
Yeah, I think the categorized step and select steps, the next two, are really where the rubber starts meeting the road for the risk management professional to get in and start digging deep. And so this is a great time to actually open the 853 and whatever revision you happen to be working on. Currently published is Rev 5, though I know a lot of people do work on the Rev 4 control sets. And actually understand and start reading the pubs. I'm not going to say read all of the controls yet, but you want to go read and understand, like go read the summary, go read how to do this, especially if you've never done it before. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to start getting familiar with the vernacular, the taxonomy of the words, and some of the things that are a little bit more common, like the thing that I want to talk about first, which is information types. And the concept of an information type is to start building and understanding what type of system you have. And that's all about, right, data. Data really is everything. And the reason why we have information systems is to process information, right? And we go back to our DIKW pyramid and all that fun stuff, right? You have to have that on it. And so when you understand what that is, that's how you start building out these information types. And so the concept here is relatively simple. Hey, I am using a system that's processing medical records, for example, right? I'm also going to have probably some administration information, right, about how to run the system on here. But maybe I don't have the nuclear secrets on this system, right? And so when you start identifying that, you're going to have the information types. And this catalog is gonna depend. If you're working in the government sector, and particularly in the DoD, you're gonna have these information types given to you in advance. Like, here is the registry of information, and here's some stuff. And so if you're working in those cycles, be aware of what that catalog is to pick from. You don't have to make this up by yourself. The challenge I've seen in that area is people don't know what it means, right? So if you say patient health information, and in many cases, these are much more granular information types, what's in a name, right? What does somebody think a patient record is, right? You can go back to the 90s and look at, you know, presidential testimony and, you know, what's the definition of is or whatever, right? Like, people get to that level of detail here, because when you get to why these matter, which is the concept of the high watermark, right, which feeds into the next set of controls, your information types dictate what your confidentiality, integrity, and availability impact levels are going to be, which then further on down the process does some more stuff we'll get into in a second. And so when you know your information types and know the information, right, we go back to our CIS control number one, like know thyself, right, know your information. So you identify these, and then there's a matrix, and this is where you get into the spreadsheet game, where, hey, okay, I've picked my information types, I've pulled my catalog, And now I can say, hey, my system, because of all of this, is a confidentiality. You know, I look at the highest one. Oh, there's a medium here. This other one's an integrity is low and availability is high, maybe because I'm processing life-saving information. Mm. And that's where you get into the rubber meeting the road bit. And this is where you start getting into the informal negotiation. Because I just said high. The word high means a lot to a lot of people in RMF. Because when you start getting into high anything, that means not only are you going to be mandated to start doing a lot of specific controls, that you're also going to have these things called control enhancements. And this is where you're like, I'm doing a lot. And, you know, hey, the first 80% is pretty easy. But then we start getting towards that top, like, what does it mean to get to 100% secure or whatever? It gets really hard to do. It's hard from a knowledge perspective, from the professionals to knowing how to configure those controls. It's hard on the cost. Hey, I have to go buy something, or I have to spend more money on people to do these things. And so nobody really ever wants anything ever to be high. And you can go look at the matrix. I don't have the reference off the top of my head, but like when you go from medium to high, it's just like an astronomical amount of controls mm-hmm. to get added. Mm-hmm. And so these high watermarks, I think, are what cause a lot of contention. And if I was to go and, you know, had a magic wand and change RMF a bit, I would really maybe make this more like the Pirate's Code, and it's more like guidelines, right? Mm-hmm. Where, hey, this is what the high water mark should be, but understand what this means, and then you're going to move into the select phase. And we can talk about that, but you probably have some questions for me.
Yeah, definitely. Jason, if it's okay, I want to actually rewind a little bit, because, Drew, you mentioned a pyramid that mm-hmm. I've never heard of before.
The DIKW, yes.
So, yeah, DIKW pyramid.
I don't know what that
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
Help a brother.
Yeah, go for it, Jason. I think you have the cert designator for knowledge management, so go for it.
Yes, yeah. I was a former knowledge management officer in an earlier life, and DIKW is really important to that. So when we talk about DIKW, these are the four types of information that you can have or knowledge. You start at the lowest level, which is data, right? So the number 32, that is a data point. That's a piece of data, but it doesn't really tell you much. If I go to information, you have a little bit more fidelity of that. For instance, I might say 32 Fahrenheit. Now you know a little bit more information, right? And so it's a little bit more than just data, because you know what that thing is about. Mm-hmm. When you start moving up and you go DI, then you go to K, which is knowledge. Now, when I say 32 Fahrenheit, well, that is the freezing point of water in the United States and any place that is, you know, using the imperial system, I guess, which I think is pretty much just the United States, if I remember correctly. And so, you know, in the United States, 32F would tell me, hey, that's the freezing point. So if I'm an insurance company, I might know that when the temperature gets down to 32F, we're going to have a lot more car accidents. We're going to be paying more money. That becomes knowledge, because I'm taking the data point, the information, and now I'm extrapolating that with other pieces of information to combine that into some kind of knowledge. And then mm-hmm. wisdom tells me that, hey, if I can work from home, I should just stay home today because it's 32 degrees out and I don't want to deal with snow and ice on the roads, right? And so you go from this data to information to knowledge to wisdom. And it's always harder to get up to wisdom, but that's where you start learning from your mistakes over time and things like that. So we talk a lot about data science, and we get all this data collected, but really data by itself is not that useful. It's what we do with the data and how we combine it to get information or knowledge from it. And that's where knowledge management organizations was really big in the 90s and 2000s. Now we all go into data science and data analysis instead, but it's a lot of the same.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think I showed my age there.
Yep.
well,
not that old, Drew. I mean, you're younger than I am.
Yeah. So DIKW, thank you for explaining what that is. Now, Drew, how does that help you with RMF?
Right. It's understanding it's the context that your information system lives in, right? Mm. And so knowing that you have patient health information is great, right? But how is that information used? Where does it start transiting your network? Where is that data stored? What legal complications and regulatory bodies do you have to work with when you have that information, right? And so as you start thinking about, right, 32 may have been a number, but now you start putting that F on it, okay, now you know it's a temperature. And then as you go grow up the period, now you're tied to a person and you know that that was Drew Church's temperature on this date at this time. And now you have a patient health record, right? And so when you start thinking about how the data comes together and how you need to protect it and where that goes in your information system, I think it allows you to really start digging into what that information means a little bit better.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for unpacking that acronym and then connecting it to RMF. So, okay, thank you. Now I feel like I can focus on the topic.
The other thing I wanted to point out is, you know, when Drew was talking about the categorize and select state, one of the things that he mentioned was how it was not guidance, and he would love it to be guidance. Whereas when we talk about NIST Cybersecurity Framework, Kip, I know you make a big point of this in our course, that this is not a requirement. You do not have to do every single thing inside the NIST Cybersecurity Framework to be using the NIST Cybersecurity Framework. It's kind of the guidelines, it's the guidance, and you can change it based on your organizational needs to more or less based on what you need. RMF is not that way. RMF is much more structured. You have to do all seven steps. Mm-hmm. You have to put a certain amount of effort into each of those steps based on whether it's high, medium, or low, as Drew said. Mm-hmm. And knowing that if you go to a high, you just bought yourself into a whole bunch of more work and a whole bunch of more stuff is important to realize. Not saying you should never categorize high, but you just need to be aware of what you're buying yourself into when you say this is a high system instead of a medium or a low system. The other thing I think that's really important when you start dealing with RMF is to realize that usually the person who is doing this, it's not that you're going to be doing all seven steps by yourself either. RMF tends to work in very large organizations. Like we said, it's very heavily used in the government and DOD. And so I may be the person who's categorizing and selecting the controls, but I'm not the actual system administrator who has to actually go and implement all this stuff. So if I say, yes, we want full disk encryption, that's a requirement. Now, I don't get to tell the system administrators that they're going to do that using a third-party product or BitLocker or, you know, File Vault 2 or whatever it is. They get to determine what meets that requirement. I just got to say what the requirement is. And that's what we're really doing in the categorize and especially in the select phases. We're saying, here are all the requirements that we're going to put in place to make sure this system is secure and has a lower level of risk. And then we get into our fourth step, which is what we're going to talk about now, which is implement. And this is what's do all that.
Oh, before we go to implement, I wanted to run away on your comment about one thing. The NIST Special Publication 800-53. I have seen so much confusion about that publication, and I've heard people say like, "Are you SP 800-53 compliant?" Or people will say, "Well, have you implemented 853?" And I think what people don't understand, and Drew and Jason, you can tell me if I got this totally wrong, but it's a catalog of controls. You don't implement everything, not even close. You are picking and choosing out of that catalog based on need. And then I remember you said something about enhancements. Almost every control has additional things that you can add in order to strengthen the control or make it more suitable for a higher level of protection. And did I get that right on the publication?
Yeah, and I glossed over a huge part of that selection of controls as to kind of how that selection happens, right? So big picture, right, you have that high water mark, and that when you go look at the matrix and how all those controls and the control families, it will literally say this applies to confidentiality high or whatever, right? And only that. Or maybe it's a low, 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 meaning every system will have this in the control set that is built from that categorization process, right? Mm. And so that's like the starting place. And then selection is all about tailoring. You'll hear the phrase tailoring these controls a lot. And so that's adding and removing controls and control enhancements in just a second that say, okay, how do I kind of tune this a little bit, right? We got the big picture, which is like objective, which is the control. And then how I go about doing that in more, not the architecture way, but like the policy and the how and the big picture, how am I going to measure this later? Though that's what's in the details of these controls. Mm-hmm. And so the control enhancements turn that like full disk encryption requirement up to 11. So it's full disk encryption and it has to be done within 3 minutes of the system coming online or whatever the crazy thing happens to be, right? And so the big point of selection has to be a conversation. So I mentioned in prepare that we need to be talking to people. And this is where the negotiation happens. And this is where I would recommend that if you're like a strong policy person or a strong RMF person, but not like you've never really worked as an administrator on a system before, your information system security engineer or architect, the different implementations of RMF have different role names, but this concept of the ISSE, these are your smart people that bridge the divide. This is where you really want to be bringing them in and talking about the controls that were picked from this baseline of controls based on your categorization and starting to pick, what do you really think you should do? What should you take out? Because maybe that control won't do what it says it will, on our system because of A, B, and C, or maybe, right, like everyone's favorite, screen lock. I'm in Virginia right now, and you might hear a plane fly over my head in the recording of this podcast. And if somebody mandates a screen lock on one of those jet fighters flying over my apartment, that's probably a bad control for that system. But I bet that if I was to go through the RMF process, that would be a control that would be selected. And this is where I think the real life people that don't think about this critically and don't have partnerships in their organizations get it wrong. We have selected this control and it will be implemented. And you're just like, this is never going to get implemented because literally the computer in the plane it doesn't work that way. And so I think that's a big thing to think about with selection.
Okay. Okay. And is this what you meant when you said tailoring before?
Yes, exactly. What do I want to do? What do I not want to do? And it can't be, I don't want to do it because it's hard and I don't want to do it because it's too expensive. Now, there may be this costs too much based on the, again, it's the old, you don't apply a $10,000 security control to a $5 hamburger. Like that doesn't, you don't do that, right? So that may come out in the wash, but if that's your only reason is this is an X dollar number and you aren't actually making a risk, like that's not your decision at this point, right? You need to be bringing all those people in to saying, hey, what is the right amount of stuff?
Yeah, I think Drew gave a really good example of, you know, these aircraft are computerized, right? And you don't want them to have a lock screen, right? Another good example of this is when I was in the Navy, I was getting a system through RMF that was specifically being used by watchstanders who have a 24/7 watch, and there'd be three different people who would stand that position. Now, they couldn't afford to log out of the computer, which was running, you know, Windows 10 or whatever, wait the 3 minutes and then log back in, because during that 3 minutes, there was time that bad things could be happening and that watchstander couldn't do their job. So, you know, one of the controls says every person needs to log in individually with their username and password using a smart card and a PIN. That way you have multi-factor authentication for all these good security controls. That's great, except for the fact that it takes 3 minutes to log out a user and log in the next one. And so what we had to do was create an exception based on that category control that was said, you must have, you know, multi-factor user identification using a PKI certificate. And we were able to get an exception. Thank you. My brain stopped working. An exception to that rule that allowed, instead of having to have them log in and log out each time, that for that particular thing, since it was a watchstander, and the goal of that control was to figure out who was using the computer at a given time if there was a security breach. So we had to do something like having a log. So the person would actually log in. I have the watch. I'm now in charge from midnight to 8 a.m. And now, you know, Jason's on watch instead of Drew. So Jason gets blamed if something happens at 3 a.m.
So you actually got a pen register.
Now an administrative control instead, right? But that met the requirement for the system using the logic of we can't be offline for 3 to 6 minutes while people are logging in and logging out.
So if I'm taking watch from you, Jason, you're picking up a pen or a pencil and you're signing in a log saying, I'm out of here. And then Kip picks up the pen or pencil and signs in and says, okay, it's me. And that is the change of ownership on that account.
That's exactly what they did. Yeah. And it was basically, you know, I signed out. I no longer have possession. Kip now has possession and he's in charge.
I love that. That's a fantastic example.
Now, it's not as good technically, but it works administratively, right? And it met the requirement using that tailoring of what does the system need to be done? And you know, same thing, if you're on the back of a EP3, for instance, you can't afford to log out when it's the next person's time to take their six-hour watch. Right. You need to continue that mission the entire time. So you have to be able to have these type of controls that can be tailored to your particular unique environment.
Love it.
All right. Can we move to number four now, Kip?
Yeah, please.
All right,
sorry
number
for
four,
the,
implement.
For the hesitation.
So
there.
At this point, we are going to implement all these controls. We picked out all our controls. We've categorized our system. We said, here is the 3,000 controls that we're going to implement on this new server before we hook it up. What do we do now, Drew?
Yeah, and I think I think about the audience of this podcast, I think a lot of people probably listening aren't going to be the ones doing a lot of the implementation. So my advice here is really about what your role of that is going to be. And if you're an administrator, you know this is where your job starts and things get really hard. I think one of the big pictures here is like, okay, so a security control says I need to have multi-factor authentication. It doesn't say what vendor I'm going to use. It doesn't say what tool and technology or process inside of that I'm going to use. Now, there are some caveats to that. There are in the concept of organizationally defined attributes. These will be listed within the controls that says, hey, here are maybe specific timeouts, like that 15 minutes would probably be an organizationally defined attribute. And there may be other types of prescriptive nature coming from the very highest levels of whatever organization you work with that may say you are going to use this piece of software or this hardware, but that's very rare. And so this is where the people have to figure out what they're going to do to meet these controls. And outside of the Department of Defense in the United States, this is the hardest thing because they're like, oh, I just got to do the MFA. Now, I work in the commercial sector now as in my role at Splunk, but my background is actually over 10 years working for the Navy as well. Mm-hmm. And we just, this is what you're going to do. You have these things. Yep. Here's the tool. Here's the technology. And you're just going to do it because you're not thinking about that at the level. But if you're a commercial or maybe a private business that's working in support of a contract, like you're going to have to start thinking about these things. And so my biggest piece of advice to anybody here that's never heard this is what some, and I think Jason might think of as a four-letter word, and I'm going to say it, STIGs. And what these do are these are the security technical implementation guides. And these say, and they're each tied to a control, an RMF control that says, hey, if you have to implement multi-factor authentication, it's this control, right? There's a cross-reference. Here's technologies that you can use, and here's literally the steps you have to follow to enable it on that tool or technology or that platform, for example. I make it sound very easy, and it's not that easy, but that's some great guidance that can get you started. I think that's a really important thing to understand is implementation is hard, and it takes time. The next thing I would say, Kip, on this is implement part of this, and there's a lot of Excel spreadsheets and timelines. Like the project management skills are going to be important here. And when you start building out your plan, your implementation plan, you have to give dates. If you lie here, your life got a lot harder and will be forever impossible, right? And so, and this goes all the way back to that selection as well. If you said you like that control is never going to get implemented in my system and you let it through into the implementation, now you've got to say when you're going to have it done by and how much it's going to cost and who's going to do it, right? You're kind of building a racy chart.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't give realistic timelines and you are trying to say that you will do these controls that you're never going to do, you enter this do loop and it's you're just never going to get out of it. And that is where folks get into a lot of trouble. There's a whole we could talk for hours, but this is where you get into this whole concept of POAM extensions, your dates weren't right. Like it's just a whole thing. So when you're doing your implementation, it's very important to like actually talk to the people that are going to be doing the work. Talk to your resource managers if you're like a project management organization and say, hey, here's the work. What's your estimate? And then listen to them. If they said it's going to take 6 months to get this done and you put down 3 months, you're at fault, not them. Like you can't just like it's the old adage, right? Nine women can't make one baby in a month, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's just going to take what it takes. And you have to listen to your experts here. And so if you're an executive. Oh, go ahead, Kip.
You used a term that I don't know if everybody understands.
Sure.
POAM. And that's a program. Yeah. Of action,
plan of action and milestone.
Yeah, plan of action and milestones.
I'll use a great example, right? I want to get Security Plus certified. Well, I can come up with a POAM that in the next 90 days, here are the things I'm going to do. In the first week, I'm going to read the textbook. In the next 3 weeks, I'm going to watch the videos. In the next month, I'm going to do the labs. The next month, I'm going to do all practice exams. And by doing, these are all the things I need to do in order to get to my final goal of passing the certification, right? It's the same thing. If I said I wanted to implement MFA, that might include buying the software, getting the software approved, getting the software installed, getting the software configured. And we're going to say, okay, that's going to take a month, 3 weeks, 2 months, 5 months, whatever it is. That total time now is 9 months, whatever that happens to be.
So it's kind of
that
just becomes a project part of plan. Our program.
Exactly. It's just a project management plan.
Okay. Yeah, and then
and the other term that I heard Drew say that some people may not be aware of is RACI, R-A-C-I. This stands for the responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. And essentially, when you're doing a project, this all goes to my project management side of my courses, when you're doing any kind of project, and RMF is a large project, essentially, of trying to get the system approved, you need to figure out who is doing what and who is being consulted and who's being informed. So, for example, you know, we were getting this podcast ready. There were several people involved, and some were responsible for things. Like I was responsible to reach out to Drew and figure out a good date and time that works for his calendar and my calendar and Kip's calendar. Kip was accountable for doing some research on RMF, so he was ready to open up the show, right? And then we had people who were consulted. Like, we may have had to consult Drew's wife to make sure that she was okay letting us borrow him for this hour instead of him calling her tonight, right? And things like that, right? And so you have these four roles that, that do take place. And as you go through RMF, you will assign different roles and different responsibilities and actions and information based on what you're doing as you're going through this process. The other thing I wanted to bring up real quick is implement. You know, Drew said for most people on the podcast, you may not be involved in the implement stage unless you're a system administrator, right? I know we have a lot of people in our audience who are system administrators trying to break into cybersecurity as well. So the place where you might be involved with RMF is doing all the implementation as opposed to doing the paperwork process of the categorization and selecting of controls. Remember, when you're doing your resumes, these are transferable skills, because when you're doing that implementation of putting in the multi-factor authentication, you are doing cybersecurity. In fact, you're doing a very important part of cybersecurity in securing the system. And a lot of people don't think about that when they're implementing their different controls, registry edits, installing patches, and things like that. That all is cybersecurity work. So keep that in mind. Yeah. And then, again, I think Drew brought up a great example when he talked about MFA as a good example. You might have a system that says you must have MFA. And in the DoD, there's a lot of systems that don't always have access to smartphones. So using a MFA solution that requires a text message is a horrible idea, because most people can't bring their smartphone to work because they're in a secret or top secret space. And so that would not be a good implementation of MFA, even though it meets the RMF requirement. And so this goes back to your preparation stage and identifying what is your system, where is it going to be used, and then deciding where it's going to be. For instance, if I'm in a submarine under the water in the middle of the Atlantic, using a two-factor authentication that relies on a text message code is not going to work. So instead, we use what the DoD has decided for most of the services is that they have to have a smart card, which is their ID card, and a PIN number. That's something you have, something you know, and that is kind of the de facto multi-factor authentication on every system in the DoD. And it works really well because it doesn't rely on this third-party text messaging type system.
Fascinating.
All right, next one. We're going to move into number five because I know we're starting to get low on time here. So next one, number five is assess. So here now we're going to do our assessment. We're going to assess to determine if the controls have been put in place properly from the implementation standpoint, and that they're actually working the way they should and producing the desired results. So Drew, I'll kick it over to you for what are your thoughts on assess?
Yeah, I think this is honestly the easiest step to do if you know what you're doing. And the reason I say this is it's an open book test. This is, you're generally not going to be assessing yourself. There's going to be some kind of third party. And I don't want to say that's going to necessarily be an external third party, meaning they don't work for the same organization. But generally speaking, the assessment of your system against risk management framework controls is going to be by some kind of person who doesn't report through your same reporting chain. Maybe not your same, like it's a third party of some kind. They follow a guide, and that guide is the assessment procedures for these controls. And those are contained in a different publication. And that's NIST Special Publication 853A, or Alpha. And that has the entire process by which these controls will be assessed. My secret to being successful in this process, as somebody who was almost always on the other side of it, not being an assessor, was actually reading their checklist, right? Like, that's what they're going to go do. So if I know what they're going to do in advance, I can make sure that I have the right documentation. Mm-hmm. I know how they're going to examine it. So I may have done it and I'm familiar with how to show them how it's going to be done here. But that's not how they check it. But it says over here how they check it. I go check it their way. And I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't realize that that register, whatever, right? Like, you know, it's done, but like you're proving it to the test, right? You're answering to the test. And I'm sure Kip and Jason have talked a lot about what's the right answer to a question. It's the one that the test writer wanted you to get. And they're giving you the test ahead of time. And so go read 853 Alpha. That's the short version. The next bit of that is understand three key words. And this is to all of the people who might perform an assessment because they get tapped on the shoulder to come help a team. There are three concepts: observe, interview, and test, right? And these are how things will be assessed, right? So observe, right? Go watch it happen. If you said that the screen lock was going to do in 15 minutes, get a stopwatch out, right? Wait 15 minutes and did it lock with no inactivity? Okay, yep, pass the test. Interview, very simple. Go talk to people. Go talk to a couple of people. Did they give the right answer? Good. Test. Now, on the screen lock one, right, like you kind of observed and test, and so there's some crossover here. But maybe if you said it's a multi-factor authentication, right, ask somebody, like have them provision you a user account and with a username and password, and then go try and log into a system. And if the system doesn't let you log in because it now asks you for some kind of second factor to authenticate into that system, you've now tested to say that that's successful. And so those are really, like, that's the whole process. And they're just doing that for all of the controls. Money and time are not infinite. Different assessors and the organizations that support them are going to have different skill sets. They're going to have different priorities, and they're going to probably have communications with whomever the authorizing official, which we'll get to here in just a second, what they care a lot about. A quick story here is I've done a number of systems on a very traditional streamlined RMF process following the same people that Jason's worked very closely with. They have a very regimented process. Here's how you're going to do absolutely everything. There's no room for deviation because it's really a gigantic bureaucracy. Things are getting better, but it's still, at the end of the day, it's a long process, very strict in the process. I worked on the side doing for other people that have it that do RMF, but they do it a little different way. And literally the person that was doing the assessment for the package called the authorizing official at the kickoff of the assessment and said, what do you care about? And that conversation really fed into the entire assessment plan of what we were going to do and how we assess the system. And it was much more effective. And we got out what they cared about because they were the people who owned the information. I think that was really important. And I hope that as people maybe embark on their own organizational journeys of RMF, or people listening, and maybe there's somebody in a DoD organization that's like in charge of something, like, that's a great way to do this. The last piece of advice on assessment that I would say here is, like, give grace to one another, because a lot of the time the people coming in to assess you aren't going to know maybe your system as well as you do, or the tool or technology that you chose to do it. So they're going to maybe ask what are perceived to be ridiculous or silly questions, or maybe make them appear ignorant. And they may be some of the smartest people, but they just don't know how this particular vendor's product implements that control. So going back to what we talked about a little bit before, and it sounds like Kip and Jason have talked at length about, this goes back to your soft skills. So understand that these people are not your enemies. It may feel like it's a battle. It may feel like it's a war, and their adversaries. Don't treat them that way. And this will be a much better time.
Yeah, the other thing I would say that I've had a lot of success with the RMF process is, as Drew said, knowing what you're being graded on and the format that they're expecting to see that in. So there may be things where it says, you know, are you doing proper logging? And that person may want to do that as simply an interview and go, hey, Drew, do you guys do logging? Yes, we do. Okay, check, move on, right? Or you may get an assessor who's saying, well, show me your logs. Show me exactly how often you rotate your logs. Show me how you're protecting your logs and you encrypt them. Show me all of these things, in which case you got to log in the system and show them that. If you already know ahead of time what you're going to be asked, you can actually have all this stuff ready to go. I had one system I was doing an RMF on, and they originally scheduled a week-long assessment. We were done in 2 days because by the time they showed up, we had everything printed out. We had all the checklists. We knew exactly what to show them. I had basically a big binder, and I just walked them through everything, and they go, great, you guys are good. Check, move on. We're out of here. So there is some of that. And then the other thing I wanted to mention as far as the assess goes is, for those of you looking for a cybersecurity career, this tends to fall into the IT auditing bucket. So if you're going to be an IT auditor, very checklist oriented, very much checking, are these controls right? Are you observing them? Are you testing them? Are you interviewing about them? And making sure that they're meeting all of the requirements that were set back in the categorize and select. Now remember, all the way back in step 2 and 3, we categorized and we selected what we're going to basically be graded on by choosing all those different controls. And now it's our turn to live up and show that, yes, we've made those controls actually a reality. All right, number 6. This gets to be the what should be a very easy part, which is the authorization place. So in the number 6 of the risk management framework, we go to authorize. And this is where your senior official is going to make their risk decision based on whether or not they want to authorize that system to actually be able to operate. So if I was in the military, for instance, and I went through the RMF process, I've got this brand new system that's going to connect to the top secret network. Somebody has to say, yes, you can connect that. Now, where this gets a little funky in the real world is sometimes they have a hard time figuring out who is the senior official who should actually be the one to make that risk decision. And we could talk a little bit about that as well. But Drew, from your perspective, what have you seen that are challenges inside this authorization space? For me, the biggest one I've seen is the finger pointing of who is the right authorizing official.
Yeah, fortunately, I've never had the who is the right person. We know exactly who the right person is. They just don't have time. And so really, I talk a lot about, in my civilian capacity, about zero trust. And so it's in vogue right now. here in RMF, you got to have some trust. And so if you're an authorizing official, these things need to be delegated out, right? So maybe you have an expert of these types of systems. Maybe like you have a delegated authorizing official for healthcare systems, right? Because they are very up to speed on, you know, all the latest in HIPAA and all, as we look at, you know, a global company and organizations, right? The different like nuances there. So they're the ones that get to make that risk decision unless there's like, it rises to some high level, right? So as practitioners, generally speaking, this is where people in suits and ties, wearing, you know, scrambled eggs on their hats that we call covers, like very important people are having conversations. And this is where there's going to be a lot of prepping your boss to go have meetings and just be honest and truthful, but give them what they need to know and not a whole lot of extra stuff, right? This goes back, you probably heard the, you know, you're talking to a lawyer. Hey, do you know what time it is? The correct answer is yes or no. It is not. It is 5:36 p.m., right? Just say, yep. Hey, is this control done? The answer is yes. If like the answer is no, no, and it'll be done by this day or whatever it happens to be. So I think that's really important. Other than that, this is up usually like if you've done everything above it, it's a check. And you move on, there's usually some kind of formal documentation. And if that formal documentation happens, that's when there's a huge party and you print it up like poster size, tack it to the wall. Everybody goes home and, you know, 59 minutes early.
Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about authorized, you know, the cases where I've had issues is specifically about five to 10 years ago, the Navy started doing a switch and they created a cyber a fleet cyber command that was now in charge of authorization. Well, a lot of the other commanders in different fleet areas like the Pacific region or the African region or the Europe region thought, well, hey, I used to be the authorizing official for all these computer networks. I still should be able to because it's operating in my network, in my geographical region. And so we had a lot of fights in there of who was the authorizing official and why could these people who used to be able to be authorizing officials no longer become authorizing officials? And when can they still act as an authorizing official? And there was, I think a lot of that has gotten fixed over the last 5 to 10 years, but that was something I saw a lot of finger pointing back and forth with some of this, where people just didn't know who was the person who was authorized. They go, look, I got approved. And like, oh no, that person wasn't actually authorized to approve that. And that became an issue. So,
you know, that's fascinating because I thought what you were going to say is that people were fighting to not be the authorizing official, because that's what I see in the private sector, where I would go to somebody and say, will you please sign off on this risk? And they're like, nope, not me. I don't sign off on risks. And it's like, I couldn't get anybody to sign anything.
Well, that became like a real big issue, especially, you know, I can speak for the Navy because I spent a lot of years working in and around the Navy. And what I saw was, you know, the operational commanders, they want to be able to approve it, because if they can approve it, they can make that process go as fast as they need. So when they have a brand new system, they say, I want this on here because it can do this new thing I need to be able to fight this war. I don't want to wait 2 years for Fleet Cyber Command to eventually get around to going through the 7 steps. And they just wanted to fast track it by doing everything internal to their staff. They would do their own categorization, selection, implementation. They'd assess themselves and then bring it to the Admiral. You know, as Drew said, the scrambled eggs, it's yellow on the top of their cap if you're an O5 or above in the pecking order of rank in the military, at least in the Navy. And so that's how you tell who's the important people, is if they have this, you know, scrambled eggs on their hat. And they want to be able to just sign it and say, yep, go ahead and connect that thing. And there's a lot of issues because of the way the networks are built with the Navy that you can't always do that, because they only see their little portion of it, not the larger network that everybody else is tied into. So that's where I've seen a lot of problems with the authorized step. So just keep that in mind, depending on where you work, that may become an issue. But as Drew said, if you prepare ahead of time, the authorization step should be fairly quick and fairly painless. The biggest thing is just getting it onto their desk, because by the time you're done with this RMF package, it's 100, 200, 300 pages of documentation. And trying to get somebody's attention to go through that and then say yes, that can be the time-consuming part, because it's just so long. They go, oh, I don't have time for that today. I'll get to it tomorrow. And then 3 months later, they're still, I'll get to it tomorrow. So that's kind of the biggest issue I've had with the authorization piece of it. And then the last step we get to is monitor, which is step 7. And this is where you're going to continuously monitor your control implementation and all the risks to your system, which is the end of our 7 steps. And at this point, you're basically doing all the work of a cybersecurity analyst to make sure your risk controls are meeting the need, that people aren't breaking into your network, that everything is working properly. And if it's not, then you want to go back and select some new controls to mitigate new risks and be able to go through. One last thing I forgot to mention as far as authorize. The outcome of authorize, there's 3 possible outcomes you can have. One is you could be accepted and you get your 3-year authorization to operate. One is you can be rejected and they say, nope, you're not secure enough. I'm not willing to accept the risk. Too risky. Go away. Hmm. And the third is you can get what's called a interim authority to operate, or IATO, which gives you 12 months. Essentially, they say, you're still kind of risky. I don't want to give you a full authorization. So I'm going to give you the authority to start working the system, plug it in, get it going. But based on your POAM, over the next 12 months, these are all the things you need to fix in order to go from this IATO into the full ATO. And I've seen a lot of IATOs in over the years. The biggest problem with that is now it's a one-year refresh cycle instead of a three-year refresh cycle. And so you are going to have to go through this RMF process and go through your POAM pretty quickly to make sure it's authorized. Otherwise, they will pull you off the network in a year. So keep that in mind as well. Sorry, back to Monitor now. Drew, what are your thoughts on Monitor?
No, I think that's actually a really great point. I'm glad you brought up the results of the authorization step, because it does feed into Monitor significantly, right? You tied it in beautifully, right? Right. If you're a SOC analyst right now, why are you doing that? And the answer should be because people have made a risk decision that have said, hey, the way we've staffed this, the way we funded it, the way what tooling we put in there, all the sensors and things sending it into your SIM, like, there's a reason for all of that. And it shouldn't just be because I thought it was a good idea or I listened to Kip and Jason's podcast. Well, maybe you should do that too, but I digress. The other reason you might be doing something is because of that interim authority to operate. And sometimes you'll hear that also called an ATO with conditions. And those conditions will be, maybe you have to have some kind of enhanced monitoring or some other kind of like, hey, we're going to be checking at this like every week, every 2 weeks, every month, whatever it happens to be. Maybe look, like, this has happened to absolutely, I think, everyone at some point or another. You have to do your vulnerability scans because, like, this is not always a continuous process. It is definitely moving that direction with tools that do things all the time, but everyone's familiar with vulnerability scanning, right? Microsoft Patch Tuesday comes out, your scanners are updated, boom, you rescan your network on Wednesday because that's when you had that schedule for your entire package to do, and man, you have the latest like 0-day vulnerability. There's not even a patch out, right? Literally, so you have 10.0 CVSS scores on every single host, but you have to submit that process. You go through this entire thing and they say, okay, the condition is in, you know, 60 days from this date of this letter or this approval, you have to submit scans that show that those are all gone. And so that all goes into that monitoring step. You're doing your continuous things, your vulnerability scanning. We call it cyber hygiene in this industry, right? You're eating your fruits and vegetables. You're having a salad with lunch instead of the burger again. I had a salad.
Washing your hands.
Absolutely. You're cyber washing your hands. So that's really what the monitoring step is. Because the goal and the dream of this, and this is why I want to leave, people might be like disheartened at this point. I want to leave them with the nugget. If you've done all of this properly and everyone's bought into it, the monitoring step gets rid of that three-year number, right? Because you've agreed, and this is how we're going to manage this system, that we're going to operate it. So they're going to do some spot checks, they're going to do some inspections sometimes, some assessments. But ideally, right, until there's major changes in the system, we're just going to operate on this cadence. And so that monitoring step is critical. So that's where you do what you said you were going to do, have your evidence or objective quality evidence, whatever you happen to call it in your world, right? It's your, hey, I said I was going to check this log every third Tuesday at 6 p.m. in my implementation plan. I have to have the logs that show I did that, right? So you're doing all of those things that you said you were to make sure that the controls are doing and continue to do what you configured and set them up to do.
Awesome.
All right.
Yeah. So I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom with us on RMF today, Drew. I know this was kind of a longer episode than we're used to doing, but I thought there was a lot of great information, especially for people who have really dealt with RMF, to kind of see behind the scenes, what does this process look like as you move through your seven steps of prepare, categorize, select, implement, assess, authorize, and monitor. If you want to learn more about RMF, stay tuned. We have another expert that's going to be coming in to talk with us about RMF. And one of the reasons why we start bringing all these experts in and start, you know, pounding them with all these different questions is because Kip and I are currently working on a risk management framework course that will be the sister course or brother course, sibling course to the NIST cybersecurity framework course that we did earlier this year, and that'll be available on Udemy and Udemy for Business. So if you want to learn more about RMF, that should be coming out in October timeframe. And we'll be doing a deep dive into RMF and all the different pieces and parts of it and how you do this in the real world and really dive into it. And I think we did a really good job today of giving a really good overview of those seven steps and where the real world intersects, you know, because sometimes you read these books and they say, hey, here's how it's supposed to work. And then you see what it's like in the real world. And they don't always line up. There's some of those things where your soft skills have to come into play if you want to get through this process sometimes. And the book won't tell you that, but it's something that real world practitioners like Drew can tell you from experience yeah. that happens all the time. So that's kind of why we took the time to do that today. Before we close out the episode, I'm going to see if Drew has any final comments or any words of wisdom to share, and then I'll go over to Kip.
One thing you said that really resonated with me, Jason, was if you're trying to get into cybersecurity, things like those implementation about implementing security controls or maybe doing some kind of IT auditing, right? These are great places to get into it. And quite frankly, my story and my entry into cybersecurity was implementing controls based on an RMF package, particularly vulnerability management, right? I started as an administrator and I got into this business through embracing risk management framework and saying, hey, this is the rules of the road. I want to know how they are. And I became kind of a subject matter expert. And that opened a multitude of doors to go do cool things. I know cool things in RMF don't always fit, but believe me, it opened a ton of doors. And so that really resonated with me, Jason, because that's my story. So I hope that becomes a story for other people that are listening to this podcast.
Awesome. Thank you, Drew. Kip?
I just want to thank Drew for his generosity and his willingness to share what it's really like to work with RMF. Thank you so much, Drew.
Yep. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Thank you again, Drew. I really appreciate you taking the time today. And for everybody else, thank you again for spending another episode of Your Cyber Path with us. You can always find this and other episodes at yourcyberpath.com. And we hope you join us again next time. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Your Cyber Path. Don't miss an episode. Press the subscribe button now. If you would like to learn more about how to get your dream cybersecurity job, then be sure to visit yourcyberpath.com, where you can access the show notes, search the archive of our top tips and tricks, and discover some fantastic bonus content.